And I think today, if you look at where a lot of venture dollars go, 80% of that goes to three states: California, Massachusetts, New York. 97%, Silas, quite frankly, goes to, white males that live in the Bay Area. And so I think we just felt like that not only was wrong, but just missed a lot of opportunity. And so, a big part of our thesis, and not necessarily because it's the right thing to do, because it actually leads to better outcomes, is investing in more underrepresented, overlooked founders from a race, place, gender lens. So 82, I think it's actually up to 90% of our investments are actually outside of major tech hubs. We have almost 15, 10 to 15 times more leverage investing in women founders, underrepresented founders, minority founders overall. We think that when you invest in companies that look like the diversity of the communities in which they come from, they end up being more successful. And I think that's even more true in climate, which is disproportionately affecting communities of color.
Welcome back to the Clean Techies Podcast, where we interview the top climate tech founders and investors to share their stories, advice, and lessons when it comes to building and investing in climate. Today, we are joined by Ryan Jeffrey, Senior Managing Director of the Sustainability Program at Generator. That's Generator with an 8. They are a collection of accelerators helping companies outside of the typical venture world bubbles of San Francisco, New York City, and Boston. Given that I'm from the Midwest, I had a particular affinity to have Ryan on because of the work they are doing to help these forgotten flyover states to participate in startup world. Today's conversation is really packed full of topics, so be sure to take notes. The topics that I enjoyed most were what they look for, specifically why founders need to be coachable, the stats he shared about how little attention these kind of forgotten areas get, Midwest, the Rust Belt, etc., and his comments on the accelerator model as a value add. And then his point that it's very hard to raise capital while running a business. I thought that was quite interesting. Overall, I think Ryan brought a lot of value to today's conversation. Let us know what you think afterward and enjoy the episode. All right, welcome to the show, Ryan. How's it going?
Hey, Silas. Good to see you. Good to be here.
Yeah, I'm super excited. Obviously, we've talked about this before, but it's nice to have to talk to other people from Wisconsin in climate. So why don't you just give us a quick background on yourself, kind of what you're doing today and how did you end up here?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first, you mentioned I'm from Madison, Wisconsin originally. I live in Chicago now. I'm the Senior Managing Director of Sustainability here at Generator. So been with Generator the last couple of years. I help oversee all of our investment accelerator programs focused on climate and sustainability, of which we've got half a dozen now. Previous life was a three-time founder, operator. Before that was an investor at a $200 million fund here in Chicago. So experience on both sides of the table, and now using that experience to help support early stage founders tackling our biggest climate and environmental challenges.
Shout out to our sponsors, Net Zero Insights. Net Zero Insights' mission is to enable the transition to a sustainable future by giving decision makers access to the leading market intelligence platform on climate innovation. Through the Net Zero platform, Net Zero Insights provides high quality data and insights on the climate tech venture market by being the best at tracking organizations and funding rounds. I personally have had a great time using this to prepare for the podcast and researching companies, funding rounds, VCs, and the latest I need to know about the climate tech ecosystem. Use the link in our description to schedule your personalized demo with the team and claim your 10% discount. Thanks again to the Net Zero Insights team for sponsoring this show.
Yeah, so I really like this. So I guess, before we get too much into what Generator does specifically, can you tell us, why join Generator specifically? If you have those experiences as a founder, you've been an investor, why go to an accelerator type model? What was the motive?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think, for me, my motivation was, and maybe I'll peel back some of the layers too and tell a little bit more about my journey. As I mentioned, I started off on sort of the investor side of the table. So I was at a $200 million fund in Chicago, investing in early stage technology companies right out of school, telling founders who were double my age that we couldn't invest in them for reasons I didn't really know and didn't really understand, to be quite honest, because I hadn't had that founder and operating experience. And I think as an investor, I was an inch deep and a mile wide working with so many different founders that I felt like I needed to really hone in and get more of that operating and founder experience. And luckily, I was at a firm where we not only invested in companies, but also started companies. So I literally moved my desk to the other side of the table, helped start a company internally, raised about $15 million from Andreessen Horowitz, a couple others. And then grew that company to 200 people, learned a lot of lessons from that, and applied those lessons to two additional startups that I helped start over the last 10 years. Was fortunate enough that my last company was acquired right at the start of the pandemic. And as I was thinking about what I wanted to do next, I'd always been passionate personally about climate and sustainability, just hadn't been able to direct my career towards that specifically. And as I started to just think about what I wanted to do next, I knew that that's where I wanted to direct my career was in climate and sustainability. And knew as I was started, on this learning journey, just learning as much as I possibly could about the space and what was needed. And I think I'm still on that learning journey, realized pretty quickly that the experience that I had as both a founder and as an investor applied really well to early stage climate tech founders. And so I just started to support, work with those types of founders on the side. And it was around that time, two summers ago, I approached the partners at Generator. And I had known them for the last 10 years. I actually got started in Madison, Wisconsin, where I'm from, and I'd mentored their first cohort. And I just sort of offhandedly mentioned to them that if they ever did anything around sustainability or climate, to let me know, I'd love to co-invest or support or mentor those startups. And they came back a couple weeks later and said, hey, we want to do something in that space. But if we're going to do it, we want you to lead it. So recruited me to join the team to launch our first sustainability-focused program. And I think, for me, being an accelerator, it's a perfect combination of that founder hat, that operator hat, and that investor hat, right? You're sitting right in between. You're not a peer investor, meaning you're not just writing checks and then sort of rooting from the sidelines, and you're not a founder, right? You're not sitting making the decisions for them. You're sort of right in between there. You're writing checks. You're having to do diligence. You have to source and find them. But I think in a lot of ways, you have to act as a founder, as a third, fourth, fifth co-founder for those teams, because you have to add value as an accelerator. And so it's sort of that perfect combination for me is sort of both that founder and an investor hat. And that's sort of the motivation for me to join the team and apply those skills to help early stage founders in this space.
Yeah, I think that's quite interesting. I really do appreciate the foresight to be willing to, hey, I'm an investor, but I don't really know why I'm saying no to these things. Like, and to say, hey, I should go get that experience. I think it's really common right now with a lot of young people just want to go straight into investing, right? VC investing. And it's kind of sexy in some ways to those people because it's kind of an interesting lifestyle. You get to really talk to cool people. It's almost like I sometimes joke that VC investors like to consider themselves like modern day philosophers, right? They're like just sitting here thinking about cool ideas and theses, etc. So that's really interesting. And I guess what I'd like to transition to now is if you could, you talked about joining, we understand why you joined, but can you talk about the business model of an accelerator, right? I know there's the various options, but can you talk about Generator specifically? Because I think from my understanding, and this could be incorrect, but a lot of people choose not to go to accelerators or to build them because they're pretty difficult from kind of a finance perspective. Like you might have more money if you go be a founder, or maybe it's a little bit less risky, but you still should make good money if you're in the long haul and if you're a good investor. So can you talk about the business model and that stuff?
Yeah, certainly. So I think, for us specifically at Generator, right, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that we're, when we're working and investing in early stage companies, we're taking a pretty big bet and a pretty big risk on a founder at their earliest stage, right? We're oftentimes their first, second, third check-in. We're providing a lot of sweat equity into what they're doing. And I think, although we're an accelerator, I think actually we're probably, in terms of the economics and the business model, more of a fund, right? We have LPs, investors that invest in us. And so we have to return that capital in order for the fund to perform and for us to continue to do it. And we've been doing this for 10 years at Generator. So we sort of know what that model looks like. And I think, I can talk more about Generator specifically, but I think that the accelerator model in a lot of ways, it's still, you're I think, let me take a step back really quick. I think an investor's role is threefold. One, it's to find and source the best deals that it possibly can. The second is to select the best deals that it possibly can. And the third is to add value in as much capacity as it can. I think for an accelerator, that third element, adding value, is particularly important because it helps tilt the odds more in the favor of the entrepreneur. And I think just the economics of investing as an accelerator, typically it's more expensive for a founder. You're giving up more equity to go through an accelerator. You have to be able to provide that value. And that's really critical in order to make mix of it work. And so for us, again, our business model is to invest, to find the best startups that are out there, invest in those startups, select them, and then provide as much value as we can. And if we're doing that, then we're making, obviously returning the fund, making enough of that back so that we can continue to recycle that into additional companies and grow the impact that we can have overall.
Hey guys, sorry for the interruption. I just need a few seconds because Soma and I have two quick favors to ask. Putting out the show each week takes about 15 to 20 hours between us, so it's a lot of effort. And it would mean the world to us if you would leave a review and mention your favorite episode. Secondly, if you're not already, go over and subscribe to the podcast on Substack. The content is free, but if you like hanging out with us each week, maybe we're even the kind of guys you'd like to buy a coffee for on occasion, consider becoming a paid subscriber. For the cost of one lavender latte a month, you can help us immensely. Thank you for tuning in consistently and helping us to share our guests' stories. Now back to the show. No, I like that. I think it's quite interesting. There's when I spoke with Rick Zullo at Equal Ventures, I remember to me it was very interesting that his perspective on being a VC was, I don't know, you could sit back to basics of what VC kind of was at the beginning, which is always with a very big emphasis on value add. And it's almost now, it seems like if you're going to bring so much value, you've got to be an accelerator in order to do it, because the VCs typically are not as focused. They want to provide value. They have a network and things like that, but they're not doing, you know, that extra work to get you de-risked and get you going. Correct?
I think a lot of VCs might take exception to that, and I want to be careful because I do think a lot of VCs out there provide a significant amount of value, right? I think cash in a lot of ways is a commodity. I think VCs can provide a lot of value in terms of the support and the growth. But going back to what we talked about earlier, I think it's really important when a lot of people, you know, younger people come to me and say, hey, what should I do in order to get into venture? The first thing I say is go join a startup, right? Be an operator, see what that's like, because I think when you do get into VC later in your career, then the advice, the perspective, the support, the value that you can provide is significantly higher when you have that perspective of a operator of a startup or a founder of a startup. And so, I think VCs can add a significant amount of value, but it has to be the right company at the right time, supporting in the right way. And it doesn't have to, right? I think VCs can provide a lot of value just in the capital that they provide. I think specifically in climate, a lot of them are more deep tech or hard tech focused and more capital intensive. And so being able to just write a check and allow founders to execute, I think is value in and of itself. But yeah. I think for earlier stage and specifically for us as an accelerator, right, we have to be providing that value. Otherwise, the economics of it don't make sense for that founder. And for us, it makes sense because we think we can help dictate the odds of success a little bit more in favor of that entrepreneur, that founder, when we're able to support and help and give them the resources, connections, and network that they need in order to succeed.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah, I appreciate that. Maybe I don't want to rub anybody the wrong way with the comment, but I think it's just interesting to see that there is, you know, there's like the amount of effort put into, let's call it, or the commitment, if you will, to value is higher, right? Because of your ask, right? The upfront sell is that you're going to get X from us, so therefore you have to fulfill it. On that topic then, can you talk about, let's do two things. So let's first go, what are specifically are you looking for with Generator? Like, what are the types of companies you want to come to you?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we've that sort of evolved over the last couple of years as we've grown the number of programs that we have. So as I mentioned, I started our first, launched, ran, recruited, invested our inaugural sort of our first sustainability focused program 2 years ago. It was an industry agnostic program. As long as, you know, the companies were focused on climate and we're climate positive. So doing the most to solve, mitigate, adapt to climate change. And we're focused on systems level or systemic level change. We sort of take a look. We'd recruit and look at them. That spanned the spectrum, right? There's energy, transportation, mobility, industrial, food, land, all of those we looked at. And actually that first cohort that we had, five companies, reflected that spectrum. It was all of those industries. As we've grown our focus on sustainability and climate over the last 2 years, we've now got half a dozen different programs that we run across the country with different partners, that are, some of them more focused on the geographic impact, some of them more focused on a theme or industry. So we have one that's focused on sustainable mobility that we run in partnership with US Venture. Another one similar to that with CoLab in Chattanooga. We got a food ag tech one that we run in Champaign. We just launched a carbon removal accelerator through a prize that we got from the DOE. So we've got a number of different programs that we focus on that have different areas of thematic interest. Again, for us, you know, I think because we're investing at the earliest stage, I think we look at a couple core things, right? We obviously look at team. We want to make sure that there's founder market fit and that they have relevancy to what they're building and experience building in that area. We want to look, does the solution that they have mirror the problem that they're solving, and really understanding, does that drive systems level change overall in the industry and the problem that they're trying to focus on? Obviously the market size, do we think this can be a massively scalable company overall? And then look at traction, right? It doesn't have to be revenue, but it does, you know, we want to see that there's some demonstrable amount of traction, of movement in the space that they're working on, so that we can get comfortable with the bet. And a lot of those are fairly typical for what a VC would look at as well. I think the bigger thing that we probably look at that other VCs might not as much is the coachability and the ability for us to help, right? Because we're providing such a hands-on, really impactful accelerator program, we want to make sure that those founders want that sort of support and that they're willing to take that, and they're coachable, and that we feel like we can work with them. And they quite honestly aren't jerks and are willing to take that feedback, have that sort of growth mindset. And we really try to optimize for that as well.
So just really quickly, when you say systems level change, what is that? Can you quantify that somewhere? Like, what does that really mean? So if I'm a founder, I'm thinking like, hey, should I apply to this? Like, or maybe I should think about how I'm building differently, or my technology. What does that really mean?
Yeah, so I think in general, you know, I think it has to be change that is fundamental and affects how the whole system functions, right? It's about changes that spread, behaviors that become a new normal, rather that benefits, you know, rather than small things that benefit a narrow group of people, right? You know, it's changing the entire. You know, I think a good example of it is we invested in our inaugural cohort in a company called It's Electric, based in Brooklyn, that's changing how people access EV charging, right? And their focus on urban neighborhoods, equitable sort of transition to clean transportation. And they're working on that. That would be sort of systems level change, where you're actually addressing how people mm-hmm. are accessing EV charging and making sure that there's equitable approach to that overall. So, you know, it's sort of hard to, you said, it's hard to quantify. I think it's more of an art than a science, but really looking at, do we think that this is going to address a significant number of people and change how antiquated industries do business overall?
Hey guys, we need your help with something. In order to better understand what you like most about the show, what you dislike, and how we can help you, please take 7 minutes to fill out our listener survey if you haven't already. It only takes about 7 minutes, but it will drastically improve our ability to give you the best content that you're looking for. Thanks for your help. Now back to the show. So when you're doing that, like how do you, is there any particular way that you determine that, you know, this is going to change things for sure, but will people accept that change? Like, how do you determine what's the breaking line between like, yes, this is adoptable and it's going to change everything, versus like, this would change everything, but nobody will do it?
I think that's, you know, that's a $1 billion question, right? I think I think we had that exactly figured out. We know exactly the type of company that we'd want to invest in every time, right? And
you probably wouldn't be telling me right here.
Yeah. But I think a lot of it just has to do with getting comfortable with the founder and how they're thinking about their product roadmap. And are they thinking about it from a perspective of their customer, right? And do we feel like they put the customer first. And I think in climate and sustainability, I think this is just true in any sort of business too, but like making sure that you're hyper aware of your customer, your persona, how you're going to distribute your product, get in front of them, less focused, not to diminish it, but less focused necessarily on product, because I think that evolved and changed with customer input, and more focused on, okay, how can we distribute this, get this in front of the right type of customer so that it can be adopted at scale? And I think there are certain questions and ways that you can dig into that with a founder so that you better understand how are they thinking about making sure that this can get into, you know, billion people's hands or really change the industry that they're trying to attack. And make sure that they're thinking about those from the get-go. And that is part of our accelerator too, right? We really help them think about those things and think about growth, distribution, sales, marketing, all the things that are necessary and needed, regardless of the industry or the company that you're trying to build.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting. I mean, my assumption, if I was trying to ask that question, would be something around, you can start to see a certain level of product market fit or kind of adoption. And then you realize that it's not super crazy, right? There is something, and then you can scale it from there. But
and I think, you know, Silas, on that point really, really quickly, I do think that's hard for a pre-revenue sort of pre-product company. When we're investing at the earliest stages, they oftentimes don't necessarily have product market fit, right? They're still figuring that sort of stuff out. And so I think you have to uncover and sort of peel back the layers of the onion with the founder to better understand how are they thinking about getting to product market fit, rather than, hey, how can you demonstrate product market fit? It's more along the lines of what are you doing in order? And there are, you know, questions that you figure out and sort of ask along the way that makes you more comfortable with the fact that they're thinking about that they're thinking about distribution, that they're thinking about sales, that they know their customer inherently, and that their customer has the problems that they're focused on solving. And, you know, surprisingly, not a lot of founders, not as many founders think about that as they should, but that's where we really try to focus our founders on thinking about overall.
What about, so I guess we talk about the value add of an accelerator. What are the, when you look at what you guys do, like what specifically is the main value add you have that's maybe different than other accelerators? Can you walk us through like one, two, three, what are those big things?
Yeah, I think the main, you know, when we think about our differentiation as an accelerator in particular, it's small cohort sizes, right? So we only invest in 5 companies per cohort. That for us, we just feel like that sort of hands-on approach really being impactful. I mean, we meet with our companies almost every day during the 3-month program. We're introducing them to hundreds of people that we feel are going to be really impactful and supportive to their business. We're helping to introduce them to corporate partners that are in our corporate innovation network and beyond, and then really helping them on their fundraise, their pitch, their story, getting to that next round of funding. You know, I think we can only do that and really be impactful and supportive for us when there's only 5 companies, right? So we think that's hard to do, that sort of hands-on concierge approach. You just can't scale when there's more than, to us, again, 5 companies. You know, I think in terms of the support and the value that we provide, pretty transparent about this. If the company is going to be in a lab or heads down just building the product during the time of the program, we're not going to be super helpful. I think where we really help founders is thinking about, again, how do they get to the metrics that are going to help them raise their next round of funding? And a lot of that has to do with growth. It may not be necessarily revenue, although that's great. But oftentimes it's around LOIs or wait lists or getting pre-orders or demonstrating and doing things that show that there's a, you know, as we talked about, some product market fit there, which in the end is what investors are looking for to get that next round of funding. And so, again, because we're a venture fund, right? We want venture type returns. We want to help these companies grow and scale and get to that next stage of their funding as fast as possible. And we think that our accelerator of 3 months helps them do that in a shorter duration of time than they would just on their own. You know, I think the other thing that's sort of overlooked too is when you have a small cohort like that, it's much easier to form bonds. And I think oftentimes the best type of support, and I found this as a founder myself, is from other founders, right? And so being able to go through really intense 3-month accelerator program and get to know the cohort and the other founders that are part of it and hear their what they're going through, and you know, supporting each other is a really big element of it that we again feel like is much more practical. And there's only five companies per cohort.
I like that. I think that's good. I mean, it's quite interesting because this is very difficult. You can't really have, you know, 40 people or 40 companies in there, right? If you're going to really, really help them. How long is the program? Is it 6 weeks, you said?
So 3 months. So 12-week program.
Three months.
Yeah. You know, I think that's where we're really working hands-on with those founders for those 3 months. It's not like we stop talking to them or working with them after those 3 months. It is a lifelong relationship, right? Oftentimes the duration of the company, 5, 10, 15 years and beyond. And so we're continuing to support them long after the program is over. I often talk to our alumni every month at the very least and try to continue to talk to them as much as needed, as much as they want overall.
Got it. Okay. And another question is, something I've heard, I don't know if this is accurate, by the way, so this could be totally off, but in the past I've heard some people talk about there used to be a perception with some VCs, maybe not all, but some VCs, that having an accelerator ahead of them was kind of not preferred, and then they would be less interested in investing. Can you talk about that landscape right now? Like, is that true? You know, are there maybe a certain exception to that? Like, can you just talk about that broadly?
You know, I think it depends in a lot of ways. And quite frankly, I think if you find if you're in venture and you find a great company that is on a trajectory that obviously that think is going to return the fund and more, I don't know that an investor should care whether they went through an accelerator or not. And our thesis and what we try to do is that we try to provide sort of an initial source of companies for investors as they go through our company or as they go through our accelerator. So we get a couple hundred applications per program that we run. We then downselect to the top five. So we're doing about a month and a half of diligence on the 300, 400 applications that we get per program to select the best five. And then we're providing 3 months of really hands-on support to get them sort of the milestones that they need in order to be venture ready. So there are probably some VCs out there that don't like to have an accelerator involved early on because of the economics that are involved. And I totally get that and understand that. But I think if it helps power the company and get them to a better stage and provide the support that they wouldn't have had otherwise, then there's a significant amount of value in that and a significant amount of value in the deal flow that can come from accelerators as long as they're working with those founders and providing the type of support that they need. And again, that's where we really try to pride ourselves on being able to do that and offer that sort of hands-on, really one-on-one support that these founders need at their earliest stages.
Got it. Okay. And then just to clarify another thing on the business model. So you mentioned you essentially have a fund, right? So you have, so Generator has LPs, correct?
So Generator has about 100 million AUM through 8 funds that we've raised over the last 10 years. So most of those have been raised, most of that has been raised from LPs. In some instances, our programs are in partnership with corporate organizations or corporations, excuse me, and they're funding the program specifically. But we've got a couple different pools of capital that we're deploying based on the program and based on the location and the partner that we have.
And so the question I have here is then when it comes to Climatech building, especially hardware, you know, there's a lot of talk about partnering with corporates to do pilot projects early on and just kind of going through the stages, as you mentioned, to get to the end. So are there any particular examples you want to share of where you're utilizing your LP because it's a corporate and they have a specific sustainability goal they're trying to achieve, that you can help them with those relationships? Can you just talk about that and helping some of your hardware, maybe not necessarily only hardware, but hardware focused in many cases, startups to get through to that next stage?
Yeah, let me see if I can use specific examples. Some of them are under NDA, so I probably can't. I think, so maybe at a high level, we have I think upwards of 50 plus organizations, corporations that are part of our corporate innovation network that we're making introductions to our startups to. A lot of them are looking for pilots. They want to, I think in general, a lot of corporations have made a lot of commitments surrounding sustainability and are looking deeply at how to decarbonize, move towards net zero, inject renewables and sort of move away from fossil fuels overall. And so I think they see us as a great way to offer that and to do that through the startups that we work with, right? And so, you know, we're constantly making introductions to from our pool of portfolio companies that we have to corporations to help them with pilots, to support them on a lot of their initiatives. Like there is one specifically that comes to mind. I can't unfortunately mention it just because I know they're under NDA. But you know, in general, I think one of the things that we do, especially with our corporate run branded program. So mentioned we have one partnership with US Venture in Appleton, Wisconsin, actually that we run focused on sustainable mobility. In a lot of ways, they see a strategic deal flow for them as they start to work with these companies. They get access to these the deal flow to the startups to be able to work with them to do follow on investment into them to bring them on in terms of what they need. And so it's a great way for them to fill their pipeline, and then not only to support early stage innovation in areas that are important to them, but also to support their company in terms of acquisition. And overall pilots that we can help support with.
And it probably helps that they can have a team of experts, people who understand how to run these things rather than trying to build their own program internally, right?
Yeah, I think that's part of the value that we can provide as well, is we take on all the logistics. We hire a team to run the program. We do all the sourcing and they're involved in the interview process. They have a vote on the investment committee, and they're pretty involved as well in the mentorship and the support that they provide to the startups and really working with them to help them navigate internal dynamics and all those sorts of things. So yeah, I think there's a lot of benefit for the corporate partners that we work with in terms of putting together a really impactful program that benefits them overall.
So you just mentioned it, you know, that one of these programs is in Appleton. I think obviously, you know, part of the reason why I really like this conversation is you guys do a lot of work with not Silicon Valley, not Boston, not New York necessarily, right? You have a lot of focus on these other areas. Can you talk about, generally speaking, the role of these, let's call them flyover states in the climate transition, the energy transition, and specifically why Generator is focused on helping those areas, those underserved areas?
Yeah, I think a lot of that just goes to sort of our start. When I say our start, I mean Generator's start 10 years ago. You know, a lot of ways Generator was started as a way to provide resources, capital, support to those founders that have been traditionally overlooked by the venture ecosystem. And I think today, if you look at where a lot of venture dollars go, 80% of that goes to three states, California, Massachusetts, New York. 97%, Silas, quite frankly, goes to, you know, white males that live in the Bay Area. And so I think we just felt like that not only was wrong, but just missed a lot of opportunity. And so, you know, a big part of our thesis, and not necessarily because it's the right thing to do, because it actually leads to better outcomes, is investing in more underrepresented, overlooked founders from a race, place, gender lens. 90% of our investments are actually outside of major tech hubs. We have almost 10 to 15 times more leverage investing in women founders, underrepresented founders, minority founders overall. We think that when you invest in companies that look like the diversity of the communities in which they come from, they end up being more successful. And I think that's even more true in climate, which is disproportionately affecting communities of color. We want to invest and support founders that are experiencing that and that we feel like are going to be more successful overall. And so, yeah, it's a big part of our journey, a big part of our thesis. And I think also, you know, when you think about accelerators, or the average person thinks about accelerators, they're probably not thinking of Generator, quite frankly. I think we've flown under the radar over the last 10 years, mostly because we've been outside those major tech hubs. And we're now one of the best performing top quartile funds and accelerators that are out there without most people knowing about us, and operating in markets that are outside of the typical venture ecosystem. And that's a big part of our mission and our thesis overall is supporting entrepreneurs everywhere and making sure that everybody has equal access to that opportunity and that capital.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting, this idea that you kind of go outside of the typical boxes, right? Some people would say, oh, well, you know, if the founders you're investing in aren't surrounded by all these other people who are successful in the space, they're not going to have as many examples, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, that you can get a certain level of groupthink, which causes like the issues with like SVB and all that stuff, where everybody's like, they all talk. So suddenly when one thing goes wrong, they all decide, right? Which is, I think, I'm not really like, maybe I'm speaking out of turn here, but I think it's part of the reason why we see such a likelihood of companies, of VCs going in this hype cycle where it's like, this thing is hot, everybody invest. This thing is hot, everybody invest. And then they're out. Just because it might still be a good example, it might be a good investment, they're still kind of out because it's, yeah, it's too much, too many, it's too old, it's, you know, it's old stuff, we're not talking about that anymore. So I like that. I think it's quite interesting. I guess one thing I'd like to ask you about is, given that a lot of the, especially in the industrial decarbonization, objectives, right? A lot of that industrial power is in the non, you know, outside of like you mentioned, everything besides Massachusetts, New York, and California, right? There's a lot of that in the rest of the country. And, you know, I'm from Wisconsin, I'm from Northern Wisconsin, where not a lot of people talk about climate change in any way that they believe it, right? So it's like, how do you see these founders who are coming from these areas, who care about this, who understand the local communities, playing a role in helping sell to these different areas that are not, you know, mainstream climate proponents?
Well, I think that's actually one of the biggest opportunities that we have, that I think founders outside of major tech hubs have. I think, you know, if you look at the last 10, 15 years, a lot of the most successful companies, you know, certainly as a trend, you know, if you think about SaaS sort of companies overall, was obviously where a lot of capital was going. And I think in a lot of ways, pre-COVID, there were certain network effects that were created by being in a certain area, namely Silicon Valley. Access to capital, obviously, significantly higher, just made it easier to start companies and get that access. I think there, you know, I think we talk about this a little bit and think about it a ton at Generator too, around sort of the next phase of successful companies being in solving physical real world problems. I think it's moving bits, not atoms. And I think you think about some of the biggest challenges that we face, where there are the biggest opportunities, obviously climate being one of them, but you think about the transitions that are occurring in, you know, across these different industries, energy, transportation, food, land use, industrial overall, a lot of these commitments that corporations are making around decarbonization, you know, COP just finished, and the first time, obviously, you know, a lot of talk about phasing down fossil fuels. And so there's just a huge amount of equitable, I think this is the biggest opportunity for equitable generational wealth ever. And that is not geographic focused, right? I think that dispersed across the country. And I think, you know, if you're an investor in Silicon Valley, I'm actually looking at investing in opportunities in the Midwest. I think I'm looking at investing where physical real world problems are happening. And that's, again, not geographic dependent. And so, you know, I'm based in Chicago, obviously a lot of manufacturing, biotech, food, you know, we're situated right in sort of the center of the country, you know, got Lake Michigan, access to fresh water. I think there's a huge opportunity for building and creating. I'm obviously very bullish on the area, but I think in creating, building really successful companies. But I think that's across sort of areas that you wouldn't typically look at to invest. And I think that's where there's a huge opportunity, and we're really excited about as well. Coming out of universities, research parks, those sorts of things, which again aren't necessarily, they're spread out, and that's where those opportunities are going to come from overall.
Do you see any, maybe tell a story of before and after, I don't know, because I have no context of this. Do you see any well-ordered collaboration amongst these kind of forgotten states when it comes to venture stuff to do all this, like farming and agriculture and industry, like coming together to find ways to collaborate, to make sure that they're actually being able to create some of that, like you said, a new generation of equitable wealth?
Well, I think you know, we see it on the ground in a lot of the money that's being deployed from a grant perspective. I think there's a lot of coalitions and a lot of universities, accelerators like us, venture funds, community organizations, nonprofits that are collaborating on a lot of these grant-focused programs. And we're involved in several of them, and we'll be announcing a couple of them in the coming weeks and months that we're a part of, that we're really excited about. But you know, I think that's a prime example of like building those sorts of coalitions and I think that is a part where an accelerator can play a big role too in connecting founders to opportunity, right? And where are founders coming from, building relationships on the ground level with communities, with community organizations, with universities, where the talent is coming from that's spread out across the country. And then the investors and the funding and the corporations that are going to help fund it and make it viable. And we can play a really solid role in connecting a lot of those ecosystems. And that's really what we're trying to leverage and focus on in the years to come too.
Yeah, I like that. So I guess this I don't want to like go into this too much, but I want to still understand, like, you work with these companies on a regular basis. You're seeing all the kind of the dilemmas that they may face. In your estimation, what would you say is the biggest gap, whether it's in an ecosystem, financing, something, knowledge, I don't know. What is the biggest gap in helping the founders of these companies who are kind of not outside of the main hubs? What is the biggest gap in helping them achieve the outcomes that they're aiming for?
I mean, in a lot of ways, it's access to capital, right? I think, again, access to capital can be viewed in a number of different ways. I think it's not just, you know, venture funding, though that's part of it. But you look at the capital stack, it's customers, right? It's just making sure that you can, you know, you talk to the right customers at the right time and you generate revenue that way. It's non-dilutive funding, grants, other things that can help propel the business. So, you know, I think when you're thinking about something that's venture scalable, like, you have to have access to capital. And I think, you know, I do think this is changing post-COVID in a lot of ways, where, you know, again, the primary pools of capital were allocated in one specific area or several specific areas. And I think for people building outside of those areas, there's just a lot more opportunity for them to connect those pools of capital to help build and grow the business, but they need to know where to find them. And I think, again, that's where an accelerator can play a key role in helping them find those and make sure that they have the ability to take advantage of it.
Yeah, I think access is an interesting one. I think the climate ecosystem seems to be relatively open, but it doesn't mean it's easy to access necessarily, right? You just have to have the right angles, and that's quite fascinating. This is obviously a really big topic right now. A lot of people are talking about is climate and AI. Do you have any general comments on where you see AI actually making a real impact and helping solve climate change? Any particular instances of portfolio companies, for example?
Yeah, I mean, we've invested in several of them overall in you know, through our programs. I think there's a tremendous amount of opportunity, right? I think you know, setting aside a lot of the debate around and I think, you know, rightful or needed debate around how fast it's progressing and kind of, quite frankly, a little wild and scary in some ways. But I do think that there is a significant amount of application specifically in climate. We look at some of the trends overall that's happening, right, around predictive modeling, how AI can sort of analyze a huge amount of data sets from satellite sensors, climate models, make sort of predictions about extreme climate and fires and flooding, those sorts of things, to I think in resilience planning overall for cities and others. I think that's a huge area, certainly around, you know, emissions tracking, being able to take a lot of that data that comes from, you know, renewable energy, you know, wind, solar, other, you know, renewable infrastructure, and making sure that they have the sort of insights that they need to make changes. We invested in a company called Reint in our spring program that is doing just that for renewable energy, providing more predictive insight into weather patterns for renewable energy that's doing incredibly well. So I think, you know, there's a huge amount of innovation that's occurring in this space. It's really cool to see, but you know, we just need to be careful how it's deployed. And I think that's a much broader, deeper conversation for people that are way smarter than me in this space. But I think it's something that we need to watch carefully.
Yeah. Got it. Okay. I definitely can't speak to that. I'm generally an optimist, so I just say, hey, let's go and see how it goes. But I know that there's nuances to it. I think it'd be probably best, you know, there's a lot of, you got, from my understanding, a lot of the companies that are in your portfolios are doing something in hardware, correct? There's a lot of hardware related.
Yeah. I think about 70% of those that we've invested in climate are sort of what you consider hard tech or deep tech. Yeah.
Yeah. So would you mind just sharing maybe one story, and then you can kind of explain the the reasons for it, but one story of how a company successfully got to an MVP, a hardware MVP specifically. So they have to go from idea all the way to getting an MVP, which unlocks more capital for them.
I mentioned It's Electric earlier. I think that's we invested in them in our spring 2022 cohort, so almost 2 years ago. That's a really good example of, a company that they had design prototypes of what they were going to build. It was a much sleeker, simpler EV charging focus for urban neighborhoods. And when we invested, it was just sort of the design of it. We really liked the concept of what they were doing. We really loved the founders, how they were attacking the space and the experience that they had navigating city bureaucracy, quite frankly. Super gritty, resilient founders that were able to overcome a lot on their journey and are doing incredibly well on that path to, they now have, I think, a half dozen or so chargers actually in the ground. So from concept, I think working through the bureaucracy, working through a lot of the challenges that come with putting something in the ground, making sure that they were working closely with design and taking inputs from everybody along the path, and then now in the ground, and they've got a number of other contracts with cities that they're working through and negotiating, and really excited about that potential overall. And I think along the way needed to access a number of different sources of capital, right? Certainly from us as an accelerator, we wanted their first checks, but VCs, non-dilutive funding, grants, those sorts of things that they took advantage of along the way. And I think that helped propel them and made sure that they could tell their story. Another example is a company in that same cohort called MycoCycle that is using, essentially using mushrooms to eat trash to create new bio-based materials that can be resold in the construction industry. They started with just a small prototype, started with one sample, trained the mycelium in the mushrooms to eat the trash, basically break it down and then create this new bio-based material that could be reused. And started with just a small sample, a small lab, raised some capital. They raised a $2.5 million seed round earlier this year that helped them expand. They grew their team, got a much bigger lab space, and now are developing and deploying with a number of corporate partners across the world that are looking to innovate and use their technology. It's still on a smaller scale, but they're starting to prove that they can take in bigger amounts, bigger quantities of trash from the manufacturing, construction industry, and divert it from landfills. And so it was an iterative process that allowed them to continue to build and grow. And I think it's in a similar way to, obviously it takes much longer because it's the hard tech sort of deep tech company, but in a lot of ways you have to innovate, continue to iterate on the product, continue to build it, get customer feedback as you would with a software company. You have to be able to do that in sort of a hard tech, deep tech sort of focus as well, and make sure that you're building what your customer needs, taking their input, make sure that the economics of it, I think this is more important too, the economics of it can scale. Because with the software company, each additional customer that you bring on is margin. For a hard tech company, you have to make sure that the margins are there from the very beginning. That every new thing that you deploy, new hardware that you deploy, obviously adds costs on your end. So you have to make sure that the margin and the economics make sense for it to scale overall. I think you have to think about it a little bit differently than you would just a traditional sort of SaaS business. But long-winded way of answering your question. Happy to dig in on that any more. We've got, again, a number of those sorts of companies that we're supporting from a hard tech perspective, figure out what those milestones are that they need to reach that are different than a traditional SaaS business, which, you look at multiples and obviously then you look at revenue and growth. It's a little bit different in terms of the story that they have to tell from what milestones are important for their seed, for their Series A, or their pre-seed, seed, Series A, than just traditional revenue. And so being able to actually communicate that to an investor, tell that story, what it looks like, is something that we really want to help our founders address and tell in a better way from a hard tech, deep tech perspective overall.
So I'm trying to think through this because from I wonder, is your opinion that most of the milestones are relatively similar? Like there's a framework. Yeah, there's nuances to it, but the milestones to get to, let's call it the point where they raise their Series B, which is usually the big hurdle because they figured it out, they're moving. Do you know if there's a particular framework that they should follow for, hey, going from lab to pilot, from pilot to, you know, small commercial scale?
No, I think part of it is that there isn't that great of milestones to follow. And I think my point too is that in SaaS, it's fairly easy, right? Like I think, you know, you're getting to $1 million ARR for Series A is like the benchmark. And I think, well, that's true for sort of hard tech companies like that. That's certainly like a milestone that they need to be thinking about and hitting. I think it's just a little bit different. And I think certainly earlier on, right, you think about pre-seed and seed, like, you know, you know, traditional investors that have been accustomed to investing in software know what those milestones look like, right? They know exactly how much revenue they should be doing, what the MRR looks like, the growth of the MRR over time. And so I think those milestones are fairly clear. I think my point is, and you know, I think we're sort of thinking about this, and I'd love to see framework that exists out there. Like, what are those milestones that we can clearly show that dictate that this company that is more hard tech focused is hitting the relevant milestones that it needs in order to be a successful company long term? And so it's just a little bit different. And I think we need to think about it as investors in a little bit different mechanism than traditional sort of SaaS software overall.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense. And then maybe just comment on this. So I'm going to lay out something to make sure I've got this right based on a couple of your examples. And you can just correct if I've got anything wrong. Is that when the founders come up with these ideas, right? They usually, you know, how they get to that conclusion is probably very different for each one. But let's just say, for example, they work in a space, they see, hey, there's a better way to do this. So they have an idea, they go out and they talk to people beforehand. They figure out, does this seem like something of interest, kind of following the mom test, right? Then they may have an idea. So they go and they either find a technology that's somewhat ready and they can kind of develop it further. And once they get it into a lab, then they can go, like, they get a little bit of traction, they get some customer interest, they'll probably be able to raise some money, correct? Either through an accelerator or for very early, like, family, friends and family type thing, usually. Is that right?
Yeah, I think generally is an oversimplified way of thinking about it. That's true. I think, you know, there's always outliers, and I think founders that are able to invest, you know, to raise money earlier, and to do it on less. But I think generally, yeah, I would say that's a good characterization of sort of the path overall. And I think, you know, whether you come from sort of university or lab setting or, you know, material science or whatever it might be, chemistry background, you might have a good sense of what that is that you're developing because you've been in that space. So go back to the company that was eating, using mushrooms to eat trash. Joanne, the founder, spent the last 20 years in the construction industry, saw all the waste that was occurring and applied that experience to develop something that would innovate on that problem. And I think early on, it was really hard for her to raise capital because she just sort of had this idea that it wasn't lab tested. You know, I think a lot of people didn't understand how big the problem was in a lot of ways and what she was trying to tackle. And so she had to prove it. She had to go out and actually do you know, again, I'm oversimplifying this in a lot of ways, but she actually had to make sure that it worked, see it in a lab setting, and get some corporate interest, right? Get some LOIs, get some people that said, hey, this is something that we'd actually be willing to buy. And then she had to, I think this is an added step in hard tech companies, prove that the economics work at scale, right? And the margins work at scale as she built it out. And that's sort of the phase that she's in terms of raising her next round of funding. And sort of proving out and building the business overall.
I think it's just really fascinating. I wonder if we'll ever get to a point where there's like let's say seven models or whatever, depending on what kind of hardware you're working on. I don't think we're there yet, but that's why I ask these questions. I'm always just trying to figure out where does it lie. One thing I always like to ask people is if you had to quit doing what you're doing today and go build a company in climate, what are the specific areas of interest that you would focus on? Do you have any particular ideas for climate tech startups or things that you're saying, hey, man, I wish somebody would do this because I can see there's an opportunity here?
It's a, you know, really good question. I think what I get really excited about, I think when I see, you know, when I see stuff out there that's working on really cool stuff is really around like nature-based solutions. I love sort of how can we use what our planet has done, you know, since it was created to solve the problem that we face, right? And so I love seeing those sorts of things. I don't necessarily have an idea around that. I don't think I was ever that great of a founder or idea guy. And so I don't know that I necessarily have like, okay, if I quit, this is what I go work on. But I get really excited about stuff that's really for, you know, again, nature focused, biodiversity, helping to support, you know, I think, and maybe to put a little bit more light on it, I think even if we solve the carbon issue, right, if we're able to you know, figure out how to decarbonize and, you know, stop emitting so much carbon to the air and suck it out and all that stuff, we still have a major challenge around biodiversity and around saving the planet from ecological disaster. And I think thinking about how all those things are interrelated, interconnected, and coming up with solutions that protect biodiversity, that enhance it, support it, is something that I'm really excited about, and I'd love to continue to support and invest overall.
Okay, cool. I appreciate that. I've heard that one a couple times now, I think, over the past few months. So nature-based solutions, I like that. Some of the things I've seen in there are quite fascinating. I think what's really interesting is once people learn how to quantify the financial impacts of doing some of these things that appear on the surface to just be an expenditure, but in reality, if you look at the long tail, they are massive, like, cost savings to countries or municipalities, right?
Yeah, we invested in a company called Gentian that actually just announced yesterday they raised oversubscribed $1.6 million round, and they're focused on biodiversity monitoring and you know, a lot of what they talk about too, and I think this is true. And what you mentioned is so much of our economy is actually driven by biodiversity and the amount of actual, like, the financial mechanics that go into it is pretty outstanding and significant, but a lot of people don't realize that. And so we need to find ways to protect it.
Appreciate that. So I guess going on to founders, advice to founders, do you have any particular advice when it comes to hiring their early team or finding a co-founder? I don't know how often that happens within what you do, but just anything regarding talent.
Yeah, I know you focus a lot on this too, and you probably can expand on it. But I think, you know, in terms of what to look for, and I think for, you know, finding co-founders or building a company together, I think it boils down to trust, right? You know, I speak from experience starting at several companies, but if you don't trust the person that's sitting there with you, that's on this roller coaster, you know, that you really have no idea where it's going, and there's all these ups and downs, and you're basically have no insight, no light at the end of the tunnel when you're on it. You have to be able to turn to the person that's on that roller coaster with you and completely trust them. And so I think that it all starts with that. You know, I think that there's a lot of, especially in today's market, I think not hiring too fast, right? I think making sure that you are diligent about the types of people that you need to bring on and not just hire for the sake of hiring because you think you need to, but hiring because the bubble is about to pop, right? And you need to bring on people that can support certain functions of the business as it grows and not doing that too quickly. I think that's probably part of my experience as a founder before, where we were just hired too fast, too quickly, and it wasn't able to support the business overall. So those are probably the two biggest ones that I think about: trust and just making sure that you're doing it, you know, you're not doing it too fast, and being thoughtful about who you're bringing on, especially in today's market where you need to extend cash flow and you need to be capital efficient overall.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Got it. I appreciate that. Now that's something that's come up. I the trust one, I think, is extremely important and sometimes underrated. It sounds really like basic, but yeah, a lot of people don't actually do a good job of that, right? It can be a big issue. So any specific pointers on pitching and fundraising?
Oh boy, that's a big one. I think, you know, it comes down to the story that you tell, right? I think a lot of founders, specifically in climate, if you're more technical in nature, it's very easy to get bogged down in the details of the product, of the technology. It's about the story that you tell, and making sure that, you know, when you're pitching an investor, I think a lot of founders have this sort of oversight that they hear, you know, anywhere between 1,000 and 6,000 pitches a year. They're talking to hundreds of founders every month. Oftentimes when you're pitching them, you may be one of 10 that they're talking to that day. And so you have a very limited amount of time in order to get their attention, and you have to be able to convince them, especially if you're pitching, you know, I think we're talking about pitching venture funds, angels too, but anybody that's going to invest from a equity standpoint, you have to convince them that they're that one in 1,000 that's going to return the capital to their LPs and to the fund overall. So you have to be able to convince them that this business is venture scalable, that there's a huge market that you're playing in, and that you're the right team and the right people in order to execute and do that. And that's a story, right? That is being able to sell the fact that might be early on, but that we're going to be the ones that can solve this problem that exists out there, right? And it's about making sure that there's a really good path from what is the problem that we're solving, how does the solution mirror that problem, what is the, you know, what have we done in terms of traction to show that we have the right solution, why are we the right team in order to do that. And how big is this opportunity that we can execute on in order to make sure that we're going to be the ones that, as an investor, you're going to make back your money. And I think it's also about, like, taking a step back too. It's about making sure that you're pitching the right people, right? I think if you can't logically show that, like, look, this can return the capital to the fund and be a $500 million company or whatever it needs to be in order for that venture fund to get its money back, depending on how big the fund is, maybe you need to pitch people that are angels that are okay with a $30 million exit, and just change sort of the, you know, and make sure that you're doing your diligence on who you're talking to. Hey, I noticed that you've invested in this portfolio company. Why did you invest in them? What was it about them? And making sure that you're aligning. I think a lot of founders will just take any meeting that they can with any investor, but, that's just a lot of time. That's a waste of time overall. You have to be talking to the right people who are investing in your stage and your type of company overall. If you're a hard tech company, don't talk to a venture fund that only invests in software. Right? Don't even reach out to them. I also think this is another key part. This isn't necessarily about the pitch, but just fundraising in general. I genuinely believe that you can't both run a company and fundraise at the same time, meaning as the CEO of the company, you have to find ways in which to delegate everything that doesn't have to do with fundraising. If you're going to fundraise, you can't do it half-assed. You can't do it with one foot in, one foot out, you know, spending 50% of your time on fundraising and then 50% of your time on business. I think that's actually the hardest thing for a founder, is continuing to move the business forward while fundraising. Fundraising is a full-time job. And you have to be reaching out to hundreds of investors every week, finding connections to them. You have to be then setting up hundreds of meetings with those investors and then negotiating and doing diligence and making sure that it's a fit. All of that takes a significant amount of time. So make sure if you're going to go out and fundraise as a founder, make sure that you go and you delegate everything that you can to your other co-founder, to your team. You know, remove everything that's not necessary so that you can focus 100% of your time on fundraising and only that until you close. It also takes takes twice as long and is twice as difficult as you think it will when you embark on it, and just bake that into to the thought process. Yeah. Another thing that I'll say, the most successful founders that we've invested in that I've seen are the ones that have been said no to the most. Meaning they're the ones that are out there talking to as many people as they possibly can, aren't afraid to get to a no. And those that hear that no more end up being the ones that get to a yes faster and end up raising more and are more successful on that path. And so you just have to be comfortable with the no. You have to get to a no faster, a no faster than a drawn out maybe, or a drawn out no is the worst thing you can get. So I could go on, but maybe I'll pause there.
No, I think that's good. I like that a lot. That I first of all, I appreciate hearing the direct example of the founders that have succeeded. And I don't necessarily think anybody's mentioned explicitly the need to focus on fundraising and that's it, right? Because you can't do both. I wanted to ask one thing that came up recently, somebody I bumped into was talking about basically kind of getting to know or networking with VCs for their Series A prior to raising their Series A. Do you have any pointers on this or takes on this?
I think that's a really good idea. I mean, you know, I think as a founder, in a lot of ways, you have to be fundraising all the time. Not to say that you're 100% focused on fundraising all the time, but when you are sort of in the mode of round is open, you have to be focused on it all the time. And when you're not, you have to be meeting investors, talking to those that could fill in the round next time, making sure that you're continuing to keep them posted and updated. And I think it's a big part of it is certainly talking to investors that are a little bit later stage that you get introduced to and that you talk to and that you network with. And I think that's the role of an accelerator, early stage investors is, you know, again, talked about it early on in this conversation, the value that investor can have is introducing those founders early in their process to the next round of investors that could invest in their round. And so I think that's a really important, critical piece of sort of thinking about your fundraising and how you're going to do that overall.
And is there any particular way that you would recommend approaching it? Like, is it, cause I would be curious if they're like, okay, well, why are you coming to me? You're not raising. Like, is it easier to get on the call if they're not trying to pitch them? Like, any particulars that you have there?
Yeah, I think if you know, you ask for money, you get advice, you ask for advice, you get money. Right. So, from my experience, I don't know, others may have different opinions, but from my experience, later stage investors love talking to companies earlier on in the process so they can get to know them, right? They can understand how the business has grown, the trajectory. And actually, I think it's beneficial for the founder too, to be able to say, hey, I know we're a little too early for you, but I'd love to have a conversation with you about what we're doing and just introduce you to what we're working on. And I think in that conversation, that founder can ask questions like, what sort of milestones would you like for us to hit in order for this to be interesting in our Series A or Series B or whatever? Write those down. And then when you hit those milestones, go back to that investor and say, hey, remember when we talked 6 months ago or 9 months ago or whatever? You said in order for you to find this interesting, we'd have to hit these metrics. Here, we've done that. Here we go. We'd love to pitch you in and see if you'd be interested in this round. So yeah, I think there's a mutual benefit for it if a founder approaches it the right way. And I think from my experience, again, almost all of the VCs that I talk to that are later stage, they love getting involved with our program. They love getting involved at the earlier stages so they can get to know the companies and then track their progress over time so they can be more comfortable with that bet later.
So I think this is, we'll probably just a couple more things here and then we'll wrap up. When it comes to advice to other VCs or investors generally, you can pick whether that's a VC or an accelerator. What is your particular advice to them when investing in climate?
I mean, just do it. I think I think we need more people investing in climate. I think we need more people that are willing to place bet on early stage innovations in climate. I think that they shouldn't shy away from investing in really difficult, tough problems. That's what we do in VC, right? You get into VC because you want to support founders that are working on our biggest problems that we face. And I think there's nothing bigger than that what we face in climate. So oftentimes it's just making sure that they're getting into the game and that they feel like even though they may not be a climate focused investor, that they can support and work with early stage founders in that space overall. Yeah, I think also it's just understanding the founders are the ones that are in the ring, right? They're the ones that are doing the hard work. Our role as an investor is to support, is to be there to help. It's not to punish them if they're not hitting their milestones. It's not to cut them down. It's to build them up and support them and be there for them and help them no matter what it takes. You're placing a bet on that founder, and when you do that, that comes at being there for them at the ups and the downs, no matter what happens.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And maybe last thing, you maybe already will say it the same way as you said before at the beginning, but what is your advice to people who want to get into venture or to want to get into VC or investing?
Yeah, I think again, it's I'll answer this maybe more because I answered it earlier. I'll answer it for the lens of climate. I think there are a lot of people that are afraid. They know that they want to focus on climate. They want to focus on sustainability, but they're like, oh, I don't have like a science background, or I don't know, like, you know, I don't specifically know about this space. I think what I'd say to that is that we need everybody in this space. We need those that have a business background, a marketing background, social media, right? We need people that can write and tell stories. And, you know, you don't have to have a science degree or an engineering degree in order to solve this challenge. And so I'd say don't shy away from it. There's plenty of startups that are out there that we funded, that others have funded, that are hiring for people that may, that need that sort of background across industries and focus areas. And, you know, I think if you wanted to get into VC and climate, again, I think the best way to do that is to support, start working and building relationships with founders that are in this space, or start something yourself.
Awesome. Well, I really appreciate that. I think we've gone through quite a lot of really good stuff today, and really excited that you came on. I appreciate this. I think what you guys are doing is quite interesting. Again, a little bit of an affinity for some of the focus on the Midwest, but I really like this. Any final thoughts or where people can reach you?
Yeah, I'm always available. Ryan@generator.com. That's generator with an 8, the number in it. LinkedIn, anywhere else, happy to connect, and love building connections and talking to founders, other investors, supporters, mentors. Again, we look to sort of connect the full ecosystem, and so want to talk and chat with as many people as we possibly can that want to be in this space and that are working in this space. So Silas, I appreciate you having me on. Thanks so much for the thoughtful questions, and appreciate your time.
Nah, pleasure is mine. It's really been a pleasure to have you on. I really, really enjoyed this. So thanks so much, Ryan.